This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Father James Martin. He is a Jesuit priest, author, and editor-at-large of America Magazine. I spoke with him on December 2, 2014, from Calliopeia Studio at On Being on Loring Park. He was at the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York. Honoring our guest's request, we've excised a couple of minutes after the end of the interview. You can download the MP3 of our produced show with Father James Martin at onbeing.org. Hello, Father Martin. Oh, Chris. Okay. Hello, Father Martin.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, good.
Hey, but first thing I want to say is I love your show.
Well, thank you.
I listen to it all the time.
Well, that means a lot.
Yeah, I love it. Love it, love it, love it. And I do.
Well,
and that is not false praise.
Makes me very happy.
Yeah, yeah. It's just awesome. You must love doing it.
Yeah, I do. I do love doing it. But I always caution people from putting my job up on a pedestal because, like every job, you know, the part that's most romantic out on the surface is not what I get to spend 100% of my time doing. You know what I mean?
I can't imagine that there are any problems with your job or anything you do. It must be, it's perfect, right?
Yeah. When people say, oh, I wish I were you, you could spend all your time.
Oh, I know.
In conversation.
That's all you do.
It's like, that's when I'm not raising money and
I know. No, I know.
Making dinner for my children and taking out the trash. And
yeah, you know. No, I mean, I always say to people, compare and despair. You know, because what happens, this is my little thing, And people do it to me, and I do it to other people. This perfect person. And then, you know, you compare it to your mixed bag life, and guess which loses out, you know?
I know. Well, so. but you know in detail.
I know. Well, I get, oh, it must be so wonderful to always be in communion with God.
That's right.
And I was like, yeah, that's 24/7.
That's right.
I don't even have to think about it anymore.
Yeah. Well, there's a little technical thing happening in the room right now, but as soon as it's done, we'll be live. I don't want to talk about anything substantive before we start because I'm afraid we will.
Okay.
You know, I want us to be really superficial right now for a few minutes.
I'm very good at that. I'd actually prefer to do the deep stuff now and be totally superficial.
No,
in the interview.
Sorry, it won't work that way.
You know, can I ask Leszek? Can you turn down my volume a little bit? Is that okay? Of my own voice. Yeah, my own voice. Thank you so much.
Chris, how are we doing?
Blah.
Do you need any, what you had for breakfast
or anything
like that?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Felt like I was shouting at myself.
Where are you now? What studio are you in?
Carnegie Hall.
Okay.
Which also people think, you know, like I'm recording on the stage.
Yeah. Well, they'll also think that we were sitting in the room together, and they'll be stunned when we tell them that we were only connected by headphones.
Actually, I find that it's better this way for radio.
It's very intimate. It's really wonderful.
Well, but also you can, I mean, I'm telling you this, you know this, you know, one has to sort of communicate only through your voice and your words and say it to be really clear rather than, you know, if you're in person.
That's right. And also, it's the, you know, all we have to work with is the human voice, and that's all the listener has to work with. So when you're sitting with someone and you have the benefit and the distraction of all that body language and visuals and eye contact, that can muddy just kind of the pure conversation.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. Plus, I don't like to deal with people one-on-one. I don't like people, so to keep away. It's not part of my ministry.
That's right. Well, okay. I think we have the green light. We can start.
Okay.
We can start talking about deep things now, if we feel like it. So it was really fun. You know, of course, I've known about you and kind of read you for years, and it was fun to dive in. I did not know the part of your story that, you know, that you didn't, you know, because you are known as a religious figure, you know, it didn't surprise me that much that you didn't grow up especially religious. or grow up to be religious, but I did not realize that you studied business in college and worked in corporate finance for GE into your mid-20s, and only then were captured, it seems, by Thomas Merton. Is that right? Was that really what the big turning point for you?
It was. I grew up, what I say, in a lukewarm Catholic family. That doesn't mean my parents weren't good people or Catholic, but, you know, we weren't super Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly never thought about being a priest, or I didn't know what a Jesuit was. And I went to the Wharton School of Business from 1978 to 1982 and got a degree in finance. We were told finance, not finance. That's, you know, it's much
I'm glad
more
I learned
prestigious.
That at this late stage
yes.
in my life.
Yes. And I took a job with GE, General Electric in New York, and worked for GE in finance and accounting and then in human resources at GE Capital, their financial services arm, for 6 years before I figured that this was just not the right place for me. And I came home one night, and in the midst of a lot of confusion about my future, I turned on the TV and saw a documentary about Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, who I had never heard of. And the documentary was so compelling that it prompted me to go out and read his book, The Seven-Story Mountain, which, you know, to coin a phrase, changed my life. And that kind of led to the Jesuits. But, yeah, it's amazing looking back how God was able to work through all of that and through all that confusion and through a lot of ignorance on my part, too.
It's pretty amazing the number of really interesting monastics in particular who were led down that path by Thomas Merton's book, The Seven-Story Mountain, isn't it? I mean, you must have come across that.
Oh, dozens.
So
and,
many.
You know, here's a book written in the 40s that still speaks to people. And I think, you know, for those who don't know what it's about, you know, he's a sort of a lost young man who lives a fairly dissolute life, born in France, studies in England, finally comes to Columbia University, and stumbles on the Trappist monks and finds his
Didn't
vocation and enters.
Did his father a child as well in there? I mean, he was a...
Well, you know, there's a lot of
Is that not...
controversy about
oh,
that.
Okay.
Let's say he thought that he fathered
okay.
a child.
Okay, so he could have fathered a child, which yeah, tells well, us what he was up to.
Yeah, he was... Yeah. I mean, he really was kind of tomcatting around and, you know, over in the UK and then in the United States. And he has a kind of aimless, sad life early on, and he finds the monastery. And he's happy. And I think, you know, one I've you know, conducted book clubs and retreats and given talks and stuff like that. And I think one of the things that people like about Merton is his passion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's very black and white, you know, early on, you know, world bad, monastery good. But they
well,
connect
right.
with his
Seven
passion.
Story Mountain. I mean, isn't it true that later on he was kind of embarrassed by that book because it is that it has that zeal of a convert, right?
Mm-hmm. He was.
Yeah.
He said, I don't know the man that wrote that
yeah.
book. You know,
yeah.
it was very judgmental about other religions.
Right, right. And about a lot, the way one can be in one's 20s and 30s.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I found the perfect life and everybody else is,
yeah.
you know, kind of like sheep.
Yeah.
And then he has this epiphany later on in his life where he realizes he's on a street corner in Louisville where he realizes I'm like everybody else and everybody's like me and it's this beautiful connection. So nonetheless, that book still appeals to people.
You know, I also noticed that you found his book "No Man Is an Island" important mm. because I'd say that's the book that kind of crossed my path at a moment where I was opening my mind to all of this in a new way and was really transformative and somewhere in your one of your books you pull out this first paragraph of "No Man Is an Island," you know. Why do we spend our lives striving to be something that we would never want to be if only we knew what we wanted? Why do we waste our time doing things which, if we only stop to think about them, are just the opposite of what we were made for?
Yeah, that's the line that changed my life, really. And I just thought, why? Why am I doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like he was speaking directly to me. And I felt like, you know, business is a real vocation for a lot of people. And it just wasn't for me. And I was miserable. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't know how I could find a way out. And that sentence, which really was like a thunderbolt, just prompted me to just shake things up. and ask myself that question. I always say to young people, you know, what would you want to do if you could do anything that, you know, you could do? It's a very clarifying question for people. And that's, you know, Jesus asks people that, you know, what do you want? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of understanding your desires. So, yeah, I love that paragraph. I go back to it a lot.
But I think, you know, there's some subtlety to this because that's not a question that's not asked in certain contexts in American culture. But it's often the connotations are often like, what would you be, which means what would you have as a career? What kind of money mm-hmm. would you be making, right? What would your job mm-hmm. title be? How would you be changing the world or succeeding? And I think that there's a distinction between that and the way you talk about vocation. I mean, even the way you just said, you know, that vocation, that you can have, that business can be a vocation, mm-hmm. wasn't yours.
Yeah.
Or the language of calling, mm-hmm. which you use and is very much used in the sense of monastic and religious professions. But I think something that really runs through all your writing is that callings and vocation, as opposed to mere career, is not something that's restricted to monastics.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Or priests or sisters or brothers. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a vocation. I mean, the most fundamental vocation is to become the person, you know, whom God created. And it's both the person you already are and the person that God calls you to be. And I think we find that out through our desires, you know, what moves us, what touches us, you know, what are we drawn to? Part of that's career, you know, but only part of it. I mean, it's really who you're called to be, and that's why that question really spoke to me. But, yeah, there's a popular misconception that having a quote-unquote vocation means that you have to be a priest or a sister or a brother. But a vocation is, you know, your deepest identity, and as well, you know, being called to married life or being a lawyer or a
yeah, being a parent,
or,
I think, is a vocation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, much harder vocation than being a priest, frankly. You know, we don't get up at 3 a.m. for feedings.
Well, you don't get any of that training. You just plunged into
no,
it.
No, we do not.
I mean, I love, you know, and I love the use of the word desire, because, again, I think if we do separate, if we do think about, you know, vocation or calling in kind of narrow spiritual terms, which sounds very serious, then we probably wouldn't use that language of desire, that it has to do with your desires, and in fact being in touch with them is one kind of compass. But in fact, there is a very long and deep philosophical and theological tradition of thinking about desire and calling.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a Jesuit, and our founder, St. Ignatius, in his classic text, The Spiritual Exercises, talked about praying for what you desire, and also praying to understand your desires. You know, what are your deepest desires that moves you? Because I believe that your deepest desires, the things that you're drawn to, the person you're called to be, are really God's desires for you. I mean, how else would God call us to something? You know, you think of a married couple, that's the easiest example. You know, they're drawn to each other. And that you would ask them, do you feel drawn to each other? Do you feel God drew you to one another? They'd say, sure. Well, how does that happen? Desire. Physical, emotional, spiritual. It's the same in different jobs. It's the same in religious vocations. But it's also the same in the person you desire to be. I think we all have an image of the person we want to become, you know, more loving, more open, more free.
Mm-hmm.
That's a call. That is God calling you to become that person. And it starts with desire, which I think is so beautiful. That just it's helping people understand that and recognizing it, that it in a way that to tell them it's not selfish. You know, desire ultimately is not selfish.
Yeah, it's freeing, and it opens the possibility that this, you know, not necessarily is easy, but is a process that has joy in it and delight
and heartache sometimes
as we
let go of the things that we're not called to be and the parts mm-hmm. of our lives that, you know, are keeping us back. I mean, this comes up again and again in direction. I mean, people, they
in
see who they
direction.
Are before God. Yeah, mm-hmm. they in spiritual direction, they see who they are before God, and they feel this sense of wanting to, you know, in a sense, move beyond that and become someone different. And I always tell them, this is good. This is God calling you. You know, this is a process, and it's ultimately liberating, which is a great message for people.
Yeah. So, you know, spiritual direction is an example of something, I think, like like contemplation in Christianity that that for a long time was kind of consigned to experts, monks and nuns, mm-hmm. professional religious mm-hmm. people. And that modern, 21st century people are rediscovering, contemplative meditative practices and spiritual direction in particular also with as almost a need that they had that they just couldn't name before. But I do think that St. Ignatius of Loyola, who was the founder of your order of the Jesuits, was a kind of exception to that rule of keeping these things for specialists. I sense that, that the spiritual exercises were at the center of Loyola and spirituality, and that's something that I think people are rediscovering also, through you at this moment.
Well, I hope so. You're right. The spiritual exercises and spiritual direction and that practice is at the heart of Jesuit spirituality or Ignatian spirituality. And you're right. Ignatius meant that for everyone.
Yeah.
And that got him into a lot of trouble, when he was alive in the 16th century. He liked to say that the creator could deal directly with the creature, so that God can deal directly with us through prayer, through our daily experiences. And spiritual direction is basically helping people see where God's activity, is happening in their lives, mostly in their prayer, but also in their daily lives. And I do a lot of spiritual direction with a lot of different kinds of people. And it's beautiful to see how God is at work in people's life. And it's a real grace to be able to do that. It kind of increases your own faith, too. But you're right. Ignatius meant that for everyone, because God deals with everyone directly, even though people sometimes aren't aware of it. It's just a question of inviting them to notice it, to be aware of that, and to kind of awake to that.
So how would you begin to talk about the distinctives of Loyola and of Ignatian spirituality? I mean, because it is very unique. It's a school. It's a genre, and it's quite different. It's quite different from other forms of contemplation in Christianity, and also quite different from most forms of Buddhist meditation. So just talk about what that is, the approach.
Sure. Well, it's a Christian spirituality, so it's all centered on Christ, and in a way it's therefore related to Benedictine, Franciscan, Dominican spirituality. But it does have a lot in common with other spiritualities like Buddhism, for example, its emphasis on freedom. Probably the shortest way of describing it is finding God in all things.
Yeah.
And the idea is that God is not simply to be found in our prayer life, which is very important, or in worship services and mass, or in reading the Bible. All those are important and at the center of that kind of spirituality. But in your daily life, in your relationships, in your work, in the emotions that come up, in those moments that you see a sunset and you say, my gosh, that's so beautiful. Why am I feeling like this? Or, you see an infant for the first time, like, your niece or your nephew or your son or your daughter or granddaughter or grandson, and you say, my gosh, where are these feelings coming from? And, these are ways that God has of communicating with us through our daily lives in all things. And then the second way we look at it is being a contemplative in action. So we're not monks. We Jesuits are not monks. We're out in the world. And yet we have that contemplative stance towards everything so that every moment is an invitation to encounter the living God, who wants to encounter us. So it's a beautiful spirituality. It's very kind of spacious, and it fits people, and it's user-friendly. And once people encounter it, their lives change. I'm directing a young man through the spiritual exercises right now, and it's wonderful to see how his life is changing. And I have other people who are spiritual directees, as they're called in the trade, and it's just beautiful to see. That's Ignatius's great gift to the world. The Jesuits' great gift is not our schools and our high schools, as wonderful as they are. It's Ignatian spirituality and the spiritual exercises. So it's life changing.
Like for somebody who'd never experienced it, I mean, there's this imaginative, visual mm-hmm. aspect, which is very accessible. It doesn't mm-hmm. need a lot of training or practice. So just describe how you might, just an exercise.
Yeah, so the kind of prayer you're talking about is often called Ignatian contemplation, or Ignatius calls it composition of place. And it's using your imagination to place yourself within a scripture scene and to see what comes up, you know, by way of emotions or feelings or desires. And it can be very transformative. So, for example, you take a simple passage like the storm at sea, Jesus calming the storm at sea. You would ask the person, you know, on your own or maybe in a guided meditation, you know, imagine yourself on the boat with Jesus. You know, what do you see, first of all? You know, what's the boat look like? What do the disciples look like? What's Jesus look like? What do you hear? You know, what are the waves like? What do you feel? You feel the cold water on your back. What do you smell? Is there a smell of fish? And you know, what do you experience in terms of like what you're wearing? And you basically trust that God's going to be with you, because you know God created your imagination, and it's an entree into experiencing God. And you notice what happens. And oftentimes, not always, some pretty amazing things can come up. For example, you know, you see Jesus asleep in the boat, and you start to realize, wow, you know, why is he asleep? Doesn't he care? You might connect it with something in your own life. You know, why is Jesus asleep? Why does not God not care about me right now? You see him do the miracle and still the storm, and you say to yourself, wow, you know, that's really beautiful. Are there times in my life where, you know, I was worried that God was asleep and things worked out okay? You know, do I need to have more trust? So those kinds of feelings can come up. You know, just something as simple as I'm angry at God for being asleep can lead you into an encounter with God or a conversation with God, which can be very healing for people. So it's a really powerful way to pray. It's not for everybody. Not everybody likes it. Some people like more content-less prayer, like centering prayer, which is just kind of quiet. But, you know, that it's the primary way I pray. And for most people, it's really transformative. Can I tell you a quick story about that?
Yeah, sure.
I was on a radio show with Cardinal Dolan, who's the Archbishop of New York, and he was interviewing me. And he told me about one of his experiences with Ignatian contemplation, where he was at the nativity scene, and he said he was on a Jesuit retreat, and he was to imagine himself in the stable. And he said at one point in his imagination, in his meditation, Mary handed him the baby Jesus, the infant Christ, and he just looked at it, and it was this kind of profound moment for him. And I said to him, and you know what? I bet the next time you read the nativity story, it was totally different. And he said, exactly. Mm. And so that's what happens. It, you know, you are able to enter into it. And so the scripture scene becomes your scripture scene, and it becomes very personal. So it's really beautiful. And, you know, to encounter Christ through your imagination that way, and just to trust that God is at work that way. It's not like you're making anything up or you have visions or anything like that, but to just imagine yourself there and to trust that God is at work through that can be really transforming for people. They feel that they've encountered the story or experienced the story as they never have before.
It's kind of interesting as I hear you talking about it. It's kind of like a contemplative, visual Christian form of midrash, right? Jewish midrash, which is about kind of reading between the lines. It's kind of like about, about visualizing between the lines in order to understand the words better.
Well, and also, yeah, you also notice things that you would have not noticed.
Right.
I did a meditation with a group a year or two ago, and it was the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. And in one of the stories where Jesus multiplies the loaves and the fishes and feeds the crowds, there's a little boy who brings, you know, five barley loaves and two fish. And this one woman in this group I was you know, facilitating said, I never noticed that little boy. She said, I've read this story, you know, probably hundreds of times and heard it at Mass. I never knew he was there. And she said, and I spent time just looking at him and noticing how he was able to bring what little he had to Jesus. And that was her insight. And, you know, her insight was, you know, we bring what little we have and Jesus takes it and multiplies it and magnifies it. So there's just like insights, too, that happen that just simply don't come when you're reading it on your own, or at least they come in a different way. And I mean, you know, I've been a Jesuit for 26 years now, and that's happened to me dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And I've heard it in direction, and I've heard it in from either Jesuit brothers. And it's astonishing. I mean, the Gospels become your own, and it's great. I mean, you know, you feel like you get to know Jesus, and that's the goal of Ignatian spirituality in the end.
Tell me tell me what you mean when you say and when you write, the way of Ignatius was about finding freedom. How are you using that word?
Well, Ignatius wanted us to be free of anything that kept us from following God. He called them disordered attachments. And the idea is that if anything keeps you from, you know, being more open to God's will in your life, get rid of it, basically. A simple example, when I was a Jesuit novice, first part of the Jesuit training, I went into my novice director, and we were supposed to be assigned to different ministries working with the poor for the first year of our novitiate. And I said, well, you know what? The last thing I want to do, I said, is work in a hospital. I don't think I could stand that, the smells and the sights and the sounds. And he said, well, good, then you'll be working in a hospital. And why is he doing that? It wasn't to punish me. It was to kind of free me up from that. You know, so, you know, his insight was, which is a very classic Jesuit insight, if that is something that's going to be preventing you from, you know, meeting people and from doing your ministry, you need to let go of it. And the way to let go of it in this case was to kind of experience it. And I, you know, now I can go into hospitals and, you know, imagine a priest who was, you know, so unfree that he couldn't set foot in a hospital, you know, or a Jesuit who couldn't.
So
do
is that this concept of agere contra?
Yes.
To act against, which at the, at the end of your, at the end of your book, The Jesuit Guide to Nearly Everything, you said in this interview you wished you'd written more about that. And I think that's what you just described, isn't it? That sometimes, in fact, we have to act against our instincts to do what we actually really want to do, right?
Yeah, yeah. So agere contra, to act against, is exactly that. And it's a way of freeing yourself up. And it sounds, you know, it can sound kind of masochistic, but it's basically, it's confronting those fears, not simply for the sake of confronting them to kind of, you know, show how strong you are and master them, but to let go of it.
Yeah.
You know, Ignatius wanted us to be free. And, you know, so for example, you know, I have people that come to me that say that, you know, I'm really obsessed with status or power or, you know, being well-known or money. And Ignatius would say, you know, are you too attached to that? Is that preventing you from, you know, living a free life? Am I so attached to, you know, another example I always use with people is, am I too attached to my health? So, for example, let's say a good friend of mine is in the hospital. There's another hospital example. And I'm so attached to my health that I don't want to visit her. Well, that's not very free.
Mm-hmm.
So Ignatius says, can you be free of that? So in all these things, the desire is for freedom. And it's actually not simply freedom from, it's also freedom for.
Yeah.
And the idea is we're freeing ourselves up for, you know, for more love and for service to God. And, you know, for the Jesuit, it's freedom for mission, you know, to go on mission.
There's so much, I feel, in Ignatian spirituality that is just so resonant with now. And I, maybe it's been resonant in every generation. But, you know, when I look also at, like, the paths to belief that you lay out in six paths to God, in a moment which I think is just, you know, profoundly historic in that for the first time in centuries, if not ever, human beings are not inheriting their belief system anymore. You know, it used to come kind of with your eye color and the house you lived in and the church or synagogue that your parents and grandparents had always gone to. And we've, you know, within just a couple of generations, become disconnected from those things just being given to us at birth. And but this in the six paths to God, as you lay them out, I mean, belief is one of them. But but the others are very familiar, you know, disbelief, independence, return, exploration, confusion.
Yeah, and that's just based on my experience with people. You know, that's where they are, and, you know, trying to accompany them. And, you know, I was on all those different paths at one time or another in my life. And there are a lot of people who do grow up with a very strong belief system and, you know, are born into a family that's very religious or very spiritual. But, you know, even those people, I find in their 20s and 30s often break off. You know, they have to kind of reappropriate it. But you're right. People are coming at it from different points of view. And I think that one of the strengths of Ignatian spirituality is that it meets people where they are. It says, okay, you know, you're starting to be interested in God because of a book you read. Great. Let's start there. Let's start with your reading. Or you're interested in God because of some movie you saw and it made you, it made you moved, or fine, let's start there. You know, what do you experience? What's your experience of that movie? Let's talk about that. It's very Ignatian, and it's just very open because, again, it's finding God in all things.
Mm.
So you don't say, well, because you weren't in church when that happened, it doesn't count. You meet the person where the person is. As you know, that's where God met me. God met me in in an apartment in Stamford, Connecticut, watching TV. I wasn't praying in church before a statue of Mary saying, please make me a priest. I was tired at the end of the day, a terrible day. I just finished a bowl of spaghetti that I'd heated up, and I was watching PBS. And that's where God met me, because that's where I was.
Right.
And so that's where we need to meet people, where they are. That's where Jesus met people. Jesus met people where they were. He didn't sit on his butt all day in Capernaum. He sat on his butt a little bit, and people came to him. But most of the times, he went out, and he met people where they were. You know, if you're fishing, I'm going to go to the shore of the Sea of Galilee. I'm going to say, follow me, and I will make you, you know, fishers of people. You know, I'm going to use a phrase from your argot, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's terrific. He meets everybody where they are, and that should be our model, too.
Tell me what it means for you to have a Jesuit now on the throne of St. Peter.
it's hard to put into words. It's great. I think the most exciting part is seeing him invite people into Jesuit spirituality without even using those words. I mean, he very rarely, he'll at times advert to St. Ignatius Loyola or the spiritual exercises. But he just does it in his own way. I think it was a year ago at his Easter Mass, he started talking about imagining yourself on Easter Sunday morning running with the women to the tomb. It was a kind of Ignatian contemplation. He said, imagine what it would be like. And I was watching with my mom at my sister's house, you know, with her family. And my mom said, do you think he read your book? And I laughed and I said, you know, this is Ignatian spirituality. You know?
We read some of the same books.
Yeah. And, you know, in other times, you know, he'll say, now close your eyes and let's imagine ourselves in this scene. And he will do what's, you know, called a guided meditation where you kind of invite the person into the scene, you know, imaginatively. It's all Ignatian spirituality.
Yeah.
And so to be able to see this kind of on a worldwide level is just beautiful. And I just love the guy. I mean, I think his emphasis on the poor is fantastic. I think meeting people where they are. And, you know, frankly, I think the key to understanding him is his Jesuit background. I mean, here's a guy who is free, you know, who does not have disordered attachments. And imagine if someone was so attached to having to do things that the way that they were done, for example, like living in the apostolic palace. He's not. He's free of that. I don't have to do that.
Right.
I'm free of that.
He's free of the shoes as well, isn't he? I think.
He's free of the shoes. And mm-hmm. but in all seriousness, imagine if he had said, I must continue to do this. You know, Ignatius would say, you know, are you being free? You know, what do you really need? What's necessary? And so I think we see someone who is profoundly Jesuit and profoundly free, and it's beautiful. I find him very inspiring. He makes me want to be a better Jesuit, a better priest, a better Catholic, a better Christian, and a better person.
Hmm. So, you know, across the years, I've interviewed a fair number of Jesuits,
mm-hmm.
and they've been really different people. You know, they've been astronomers, they've been social activists.
You know the old expression, if you've met one Jesuit, you've met one Jesuit?
No, I did not know that. But what I was going to say is the one thing they all have in common is they're funny. Okay. Really. They have all had a great sense of humor.
Well, I hope so. I mean, there are a few unfunny Jesuits.
Well, I'm sure there are.
You know, let's say more serious. But, you know, I would hope that part of that is perspective. You know, one of the things that the spiritual exercises and Jesuit formation teaches you is that you are not perfect. The beginning of the spiritual exercises is actually an encounter with your own sinfulness, you know, which is not that, you know, it's to make you feel terrible about yourself because we're all God's creations, but we're all human beings. We all have sins. We all have flaws and failures and things like that. And that's very humbling. to be able to see that about yourself. And I think that gives you a lot of perspective. And it means that that you can laugh at yourself. My spiritual director always likes to say, you know, it's harder to get puffed up about yourself when you have a good idea of your own failings and your humanity and your sinfulness. My spiritual director likes to say, there's good news and there's better news. Do you know this, by the way?
No.
Have you heard this?
No.
The good news is there is a Messiah. The better news is it's not you. So, you know, it's not all up to you. You know, you're not the savior of the world. You don't have to do everything. And you're flawed. And you will come up, and I come up against my sinfulness and my flaws and my struggles daily. I really do. And I don't mean that as like false humility. That is true. And that keeps you humble, I think. And I think that means you can laugh at yourself. And
well,
most Jesuits are pretty good at laughing at themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with the last part of that, that I've met a lot of Jesuits who are good at laughing at themselves. I mean, it's also, it can cut both ways, though. You know, I mean, you know, you've pointed out, you've written a whole book about joy and laughter and humor. And you said, and I think we can all identify, I've come across a surprising number of spiritually aware people who are, in a word, grim, and that joylessness is, you know, it's ecumenical interfaith. It's,
The frozen chosen.
The frozen chosen. Yeah. But you, go on.
No, I was going to say that, you know, it's also very un-Christian. I mean, the ultimate message of the Gospels and of Christianity is Christ is risen. Right, I mean that's the end of the story, and that's a joyful message. I always laugh at people who, you know, who say, you know, joy is really, you know, not too much joy, not too much happiness. And I say, you know, imagine the disciples on Easter Sunday. Do you think they were going around with long faces? And Jesus himself, you know, lived a joyful life. You can see signs of that in the Gospels in terms of his clever parables and his funny stories. And you know, for Pete's sake, his first miracle was at a party, a wedding party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
where
there
he was
is,
a good boy and did what his mother told him to do.
That's right.
that's what I appreciate about that story.
Although he's pretty harsh with his mother. That's a great story.
But he did turn the water into wine.
He did eventually.
If he'd been thinking about his legacy, you know, he might not had that as his first miracle, but his mother asked him to do it.
I never thought of that. Right? Okay. He wanted another first miracle.
I'm doing an Ignatian. You know, I'm being in the story.
You know what?
And
you know what? And you know what's great about that? What you just said. Who knows? That could have been it. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that comes up in Ignatian contemplation. You focus on Mary and you say, you know, for example, in the wedding feast of Cana, what is she thinking? And you know, you can get into the story and say, what's going on there?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, who knows? I heard a very funny preacher who once said that that story of the wedding feast at Cana where, you know, Jesus brings his disciples and they say we've run out of wine is actually kind of funny because it sounds like it's the disciples that have caused the, you know,
right,
lack
want more
of
to
wine.
Drink.
And his mother says, you know, they've run out of wine. And he says quite harshly, woman, what concern is that of yours and of mine? And she says, very sort of her last words in Scripture, do whatever he tells you. She says that to the steward. And a friend of mine was preaching on this, and he said, you know, you can hear that as do whatever he tells you, this kind of beautiful kind of sign to us that Mary says, you know, we need to do whatever her son tells us. Or you can hear it as a kind of frustrated mother saying, just do whatever he tells you.
Yeah. Don't.
So they are both possible. they're both possible. But yeah, he's a joyful person. And I think if we miss the joy in Christianity, we are missing the point.
And you happen to be the chaplain of the Colbert Nation, according to Stephen Colbert himself.
Yes, well, until the show ends.
But I mean, here's the question I want to ask you that I know everybody will be wondering about if you will preside over his installation at the Late Show.
I always say if he invites me, I will come. I am free enough. Plus, funny enough, it's like two blocks away from my Jesuit community, so.
You know, oh, sorry. I do pay attention to language and how, you know, a lot of the words that we most need get a little bit messed up in the way they get used. And, you know, when you talk about, I feel like, you know, the way you're talking about joy and laughter and humor is, it's not exactly the way we use the word happiness. I mean, I just, mm-hmm. it seems to me it's kind of like the difference between hope and optimism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that joy is different than happiness. Joy is happiness in God. Joy has an object. Joy is about a relationship. Happiness, you know, it can be very evanescent. It can, you know, come one day and leave the next. But joy is a lot deeper than that. And, you know, I'll tell you something. I had a friend of mine who just died a few days ago, just this incredible Jesuit. His name was T.J. Martinez. And he died of stomach cancer at age 44. And even towards the end, was joyful. And I mean that in the most sort of the fullest way. It wasn't fake. It wasn't insincere, but he was joyful. You know, towards the end of his life, he sent me a message through a friend saying, you know, the last 6 years of my life, he had worked in a school for poor children in Houston called the Cristo Rey School that he founded. He said, the last 6 years of my life have been my best assignment ever. And he said, my next assignment will be even better. You know, he would send me these texts that were joyful. And so why is that? Was TJ happy about having cancer? No, not at all. But he was in relationship with God, and he had this trust, and he had this experience of joy. And so that's the difference, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Joy is much deeper. And that's what we're called to. You know, we're called to Christian joy.
You know,
thank God, you know.
The people who this theme of humor as a virtue and humor as a kind of mark of God, you know, also is something that's run through my life of conversation, and I think it's just most profoundly embodied in Desmond Tutu,
mm-hmm.
who first of all just again embodies it. He just mm-hmm. he demonstrates
exactly.
it, and he so he is just he laughs
mm-hmm.
infectiously and easily and often, and and he said to me, you know, God has a sense of humor. And the thing is, if Desmond Tutu tells you something about God, you believe him. I mean, right. So I pass this
yeah.
on, but then if you think about it more deeply, you know, how remarkable that is. I mean, that joy that radiates mm-hmm. from him.
Yeah. And it's Christian joy. And I think that, you know, this is what draws people to Christianity. And I think this is what drew people to Jesus. You know, Jesus would have been a joyful person and, you know, would have laughed and had friends and, you know, went to wedding parties. And, you know, one point of the Gospels, he says, now you're calling me a glutton and a drunkard. You know, and I asked a scripture scholar about that, and they said, i.e., Jesus is being critiqued for living it up. You know, so he was seen as too joyful.
Mm-hmm.
in his time. But yeah, we're drawn to people like that. And the people who are most in touch with God are those who are joyful and vice versa.
Yeah.
There's a quality in them. I mean, you see it in Pope Francis.
Yeah.
You know, you see it in like the Dalai Lama. I
mean, yeah,
he's laughing
he's
all the time.
Funny. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. And mm-hmm. and it's I think it's a sense not only of trust and hope in the resurrection, you know, for the Christian, you know, or belief in God, you know, for the believer, but also a sense of perspective and just the joy of life.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm around people like that who are connected with God, I find we laugh a lot.
Yeah.
You know, which is just beautiful.
Yeah, that was actually one of the, you know, I started thinking about creating this show actually back in the late 90s. Actually, this is not going to be on the air, but I was doing a I did an oral history project for St. John's Abbey, those Benedictines in Collegeville.
Them.
Yeah.
I love them.
Who are so amazing. And so this was the era of, you know, talk about the image of grim, judgmental, not, you know, religiosity and Christianity in particular. It was kind of the era of, you know, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and them being given this platform by by American journalism and kind mm-hmm. of ask the questions in the most inflammatory way and then delivering the most inflammatory statements. Mm. But then these Benedictines sent me off on this oral history project, and one of the things that I noticed about these conversations I was having is that they were so interesting and intellectual mm-hmm. and, you know, just fascinating, listenable, but also funny. And there was so much laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a religious voice that anyone was hearing or even able at that point to imagine was possible, at least in public.
Well, I think you're right. And I think, you know, when you hear someone's religious, you think that they're boring or grim.
Yeah.
I was walking up Madison Avenue the other day. I live in New York. And I was, you know, sometimes you overhear these snatches of conversation. These two guys, these two young executives were talking. And the one said, "Yeah, I got to meet my girlfriend's mother this weekend. She's really religious." And I thought, that doesn't sound like a compliment.
Yeah.
You know, versus, Pope Francis or Desmond Tutu or the Dalai Lama. I mean, they're religious, but it's not like you're, you know, terrified to meet them. And it is, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding of how we view God, and for the Christians, how we view Jesus, because we have viewed Jesus as the man of sorrows primarily.
Hmm.
You know, and you go into a Catholic church, my denomination.
All those depressing.
Jesus on a cross, which is very important, I always tell people, but that is a part of his life. Most of his life was, needless to say, not on the cross and not about suffering. And so he's the man of joys, too. And you see statues of the saints, and they all look ticked off. You know, they all look like they're mad about something, or they smelled a piece of bad cheese.
Yeah.
And what that does is it subtly influences how we see holiness in our own lives. You know, because if Jesus and the saints were morose and dull and, you know, overly pious, and as Pope Francis said, looked like they went around sucking on a lemon, then we're like that too. And, as a result, we think that when people are joyful and happy, they're somehow not religious or they're not serious.
Right.
You know, when I did this book on joy and humor and laughter, I was stunned to find, you know, the number of books on humor and laughter in the Christian tradition are, you know, maybe like fill like half a shelf because it's not seen as important. Now, you go to the Christian section of your library and look up suffering. Well, you know, there you go. You know, you can read from now until kingdom come.
Yeah, I know. But also, here's where you get – there's a difference between – I think there's just a lot of religious jokes, I think, don't tend to be very funny. But that's not the same as humor.
Really?
Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I know some pretty great religious jokes.
Okay, well, another time.
Another time.
Let's see if we have time at the end of this interview. You can tell
Sure. Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, to me, this does touch on something I want to ask you about that something you've said, that the way you think about friendships can mm-hmm. help you think about and deepen your relationship with God.
Absolutely. And it's usually the most clarifying way for people to start to think about a relationship with God. And the idea is that, friendship is an analog with a relationship with God. So, for example, what makes a good friendship? What is required? Well, time, for example. You know, you would scarcely say, I'm good friends with this person and never spend any time one-on-one with him or her. Well, what about your relationship with God? You spend one-on-one time with God? You know, is there time? How about honesty? You know, what happens if you're not honest in a friendship? Well, it starts to grow cold or formal or, you know, very distant. Same with God. If we're not honest in prayer about what we feel, about our struggles, our anger, our sorrows, our relationship gets very cold and distant. How about listening? You know, if you had a friend that all you did was talk at, you know, that wouldn't be a very deep friendship. Can you listen to God's voice in your daily life and in your prayer? So this is an insight from Father William Barry, who's a Jesuit in New England. And it's been very helpful for me. And it really helps people because it really gets their spiritual life kind of back on track. Can you relate to God in a similar way that you relate to a friend, you know, time, honesty, openness, silence. Are you comfortable with silence? Does your friend have to call you every day and say, I like you?
Right, right. Or also companionable silence, right? Being able to, the people you're closest to, you don't have to be talking all the time or have them talking to you.
Yeah, you know, I always use the example of if you're quiet with God in prayer, you know, this is sort of the, I would say, the opposite of Ignatian contemplation, centering prayer, which is just centering prayer is just being in the presence of God, simply put. Can you imagine that like taking a long walk on a beach with a friend and saying nothing? You know, I mean, is that any less of a relationship or relating than if you're talking over a dinner? No, it's just a different way of relating. I'll tell you a story. When I was in the novitiate, I was praying, and I wasn't using Ignatian contemplation. I wasn't in some great scripture scene. It was just me kind of quietly being in God's presence. And I went to my spiritual director, who was a great Jesuit, and I said, I feel like I'm wasting time. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I'm just kind of in God's presence. Not much is happening. And he said to me, okay, Jim, let me get this straight. So being in God's presence is for you a waste of time. So it kind of opened my eyes up to the fact that, as you're saying, a companionable silence and presence is fine. It's just a different way of relating to God. And you can pray. There's no right way to pray or wrong way to pray. That's another great insight of Ignatian spirituality. Whatever helps you feel closest to God is great.
Hmm.
You know, and the other thing is, it's like saying, okay, I like to go out with my friend for dinner every Friday night. You know, and we go to dinner, then we go to a movie, then we go out for a drink and we talk, and that's what we do. And you say, that's great. That's a great way of relating to a friend. And then that person says to you, and that's the way you should relate to all of your friends at all times. So that's crazy. You know, so different ways of relating are like different ways of praying. You know, not everyone has to do it the same way. And you might want to do it in a different way at a different time of your life.
Right. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's can you be free of that too? You know, can you be free of even the kinds of ways of prayer that you use?
So, you know, you get caught up occasionally in the conversations that are happening now, and there's always some version of this about, you know, progressivists and traditionalists, you know, within Catholic tradition, and some of the things mm-hmm. that Pope Francis is doing and saying, and, you know, things that are shifting in the culture. But I don't really want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about the details of that. I'm interested, though, in this really, really came at me again. I mean, it's something I've been aware of for a while, but it came at me again reading you, that the Catholic Church has always been this multitudinous, this thing that is a multiplicity rather than something homogeneous. I mean, and a lot of that has been embodied in these monastic orders. This incredible mm-hmm. diversity. I mean, I remember this. Mm-hmm. Evangelical Richard Mao, a Christian philosopher,
mm-hmm.
who was the president of Fuller Seminary, and they had 122 mm-hmm. Protestant denominations at Fuller. They probably have Catholics there too.
I didn't know there were that many. That's amazing.
But I remember him saying to me once that he looks at Catholicism and sees denominations as well. It's just that it's Franciscans and Dominicans and Jesuits and, I mean, all these multitudinous orders, which all have their virtues that they live into and their insights that they live into and their practices with a particular passion. I guess I'm thinking about some of the ways we talk about, division and schism and mm-hmm. change. In fact, monastic orders in particular have always been a representation of things going on in the center and things going on in the margins and something that's alive.
Well, I think that's true. excuse me. James Joyce once said the Catholic Church is here comes everybody, which I think is terrific. And I think Richard Mao is right. There are lots of ways of being Catholic, and that makes sense. It's always been that way.
And there always have been, right, for a long, long time.
Absolutely. And look at the disciples. There are different ways of being a disciple. Not all the disciples are exactly the same. You know, one's a tax collector, one's a fisherman, you know, several are fishermen. And so they were fighting all the time. I mean, Peter fights with Paul. There's a great line from a letter from St. Paul where he says, I went to Jerusalem to speak to Peter because he was clearly wrong. And I say to people, you don't expect there's going to be divisions in the church now, you know, and those are people that, you know, had the opportunity of actually, you know, being with Jesus. I think the great thing is there are places for everybody in the Catholic Church. And, you know, even in parishes, you know, there are parishes that might be more progressive, more traditional, more this, more that, more interested in social justice, more interested in, you know, adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. You know, these are all parts of the church. You can find a place for yourself, which I think is beautiful. It's always been that way. And I think the danger is when people say, this is the only way to be Catholic. Now, I mean, obviously there's certain non-negotiables and there's certain essentials in terms of the creed and what we believe.
And that is also, that's a human way of being, right? I mean, we all do that. That's an impulse we have, whatever we're talking about. But
well, it's like, you know, once again, it's the relationship model and the friendship model with God, you know? Does everyone have to relate to God in the same way? No. Let's look at a person who's in your life, like a mother or a father, you know, or an aunt or an uncle. You know, you love that person. Do you have to relate to that person in the same way that everyone else in your family does? Can there be things that you like about that person that's kind of your special connection with him or her? You know, you like to talk about, you know, knitting or cats or gardening or something like that that no one else likes to. That's fine. You know, it's just a different way of relating. So, you know, God is big enough. You know, God is larger than we can imagine. And so the church should be large, too, and be, you know, and be a big tent. Pope Francis used the image of a field hospital, which I thought was great, where the flaps are open and people are coming in and out. It's a great image. And the other even greater image is the body of Christ, you know, St. Paul's image where he says, you know, we're all like a body. The whole church is like a body. Some of us are like the hand. Some of us are like the head. And what if the eye were to say to the hand, I don't need you? it's a great image. So it makes sense. And I think it's wonderful. And as I said, the only problem is when people say, when the eye says to the hand, you know, you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. Which happens from time to time,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
You know, you write in a very winsome way about being monastic and being a modern person, and and also not in a tell-all way, but I think you are revealing and you're writing to a broad audience. So, it's taken by a place in one of your writing where you say that when you were becoming a Jesuit, you said you're not monastic, right? Is that right? Am I getting that?
I'm not a monk.
You're not a monk, so, but it is a monastic order, right?
No, not really. Not? So there are monastic orders, which would be, you know, cloistered and living in monasteries.
Yeah.
But we're religious orders, kind of the broader term.
Okay.
Yeah.
So sorry. I'm sorry. I've been getting
that's
that
okay.
wrong. But it
no,
is
okay. I didn't know that before I entered the Jesuits.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess I was conflating religious orders and monastic orders.
That's okay.
But anyway, so that when you were becoming a Jesuit, someone said to me, one of your teachers or mentors said, you know, you will fall in love, right? You're taking this vow of celibacy, but you will fall in love. And you said you did fall in love.
mm-hmm.
And I think that that's important for people to hear, to humanize this way of life that you've chosen and that many other people of great integrity have chosen across time.
Yeah, I also think it's important for people to hear. I think, you know, when you enter the religious order, you don't, you know, check your sexuality at the door. You fall in love. And my novice director said, and if people don't fall in love with you, something's wrong, you know, because you're living a loving life and we're human beings. And actually, I was horrified. I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, what if I fall in love? And not that love is a bad thing, but this would be terrible. And I did. I fell in love in a very deep way. You know, I had to make a decision. You know, my spiritual director at the time, which was, you know, really helpful and human and real, and I've, you know, had this experience with people coming to me, said to me, okay, you know, you fell in love and it's beautiful and someone fell in love with you and that's beautiful too. And, you know, now you have to make a choice. You know, do you continue with this way of life? Right, which is about chastity and loving people freely and deeply, but not exclusively. That's how we say it, you know, not, you know, just one person. Or do you choose to leave, you know, and continue this relationship with this person? So I chose to stay, you know, after looking back on my life and seeing how happy I was as someone who was living chastity. So, you know, I thought it was really important to put that in the book because it's true, first of all. It was an experience of discernment. But it's also, as you say, it kind of dispels these notions that, you know, that people don't fall in love. I mean, it happens to married people.
Right.
People that are then committed relationships. And it's kind of the same thing. It's okay, now what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, now you're given a choice. What do you do? And, you know, it was a gift to me in the end. I mean, it was very turbulent, obviously. But it was a gift to me because it was beautiful to fall in love and have someone fall in love with you. But it was also a gift of discernment, and it also helps me understand people.
Yeah.
You know? As does, by the way, on a more practical level, just having worked. I mean, a much more kind of simple level. I mean, just being out in the world and earning a paycheck. So I tend to think that it's better for priests and religious people in religious orders to have those experiences before they enter, so that when someone says, my boss is a jerk, you know, you don't just say, oh, well, you know, you must pray for him or her or offer it up.
Right.
You can, you know what that means.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm struggling with my paycheck, or I'm worried about losing my job, or I've fallen in love, or I've fallen out of love, or, mm-hmm. you know, I'm having an affair. You know, it's important to, you know, Jesus became human. Right, Jesus participates in humanity, and so we're called to participate in humanity. And I always say to people, you know, there's a reason Jesus didn't come down as a book. I mean, he came down as a person. He incarnates himself. And so we're called to kind of identify and participate in people's lives like that.
And you also suggest that that these high, I don't know, these monastic or these high religious virtues like chastity, you know, you say that loving chastely is a virtue that others can claim even in married lives.
Yeah, all three of the vows, poverty, chastity, and obedience, and they're all about freedom. You know, poverty is being freed of the need for, you know, acquiring things and to try to be as free as possible so that things don't own you, which I like to quote Fight Club, you know, that avatar of spiritual wisdom. I actually like that movie because, you know, things claim you, things own you. Can you be free of that? Obedience is kind of being open to God's will, whatever that is, you know, surrendering to the future. And chastity, yeah, it's loving people freely and deeply without, you know, holding on to them. And you can be a married person and, you know, and this is Christian tradition, and love chastely. You know, it's a proper use of your sexuality. So you love the person, you want the best for them, but you don't possess them. You know, they're not yours to kind of possess. And so it's the proper use of your sexuality. And for someone like me in a religious order, I love people freely and deeply without being, you know, exclusively related and, you know, obviously not, you know, having sexual relationships. So as a result, I mean, it really works for me. I have a lot of, you know, deep and loving and intimate friendships with both men and women that I think, not that it's better, I really want to underline that, it's not better or worse than being married. That's the way it used to be seen. It's just different.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different way of doing things. But yes, everyone can love chastely, and that's one of the things I try to talk about in the book.
So you're very active on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram as well. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I just would love to hear how you think about St. Ignatius of Loyola's call to find God in all things, and how that works for you in social media, in these 21st century places. Congregate.
One of the things that Pope Paul VI said to the Jesuits, I think, was that you are to be found on the boundaries all the time, on the margins. And Pope Francis said that to us. And so we're called to be on the boundaries. And, you know, this is where people are. You know, and so I have this public Facebook page and Twitter account and Instagram, which is I'm new to. This is where people are.
Well,
if you want to,
yeah, 1 in 6 people on the globe now is on Facebook, I heard recently. So it's not even the margins anymore.
Yeah, well, that's true too. That's
we're
a good
on the
point.
Margins here on public radio. Okay, let's be clear.
That's funny. Well, at least Instagram is on the margins.
Okay, Instagram is on the margins.
But no, that's where people are, and I actually see it as kind of a ministry. I really do. Particularly this public Facebook account I have. It's a way of. Sort of inviting people to see articles or videos that they might not know about. You know, I work at America Magazine, which is a media ministry of the Jesuits, and so we get a lot, we're kind of a clearinghouse for things. So I try to mix it up in terms of evening meditations and prayers, videos, you know, not my own, but, you know, other people's articles, and to just show people the riches of the faith and to help them a little bit. And, you know, the number of messages I get from people about, you know, their gratitude for being able to find something on my page is really beautiful. Mm. And I love it. I really enjoy it. And by the way, it doesn't take a whole lot of time, you know, just maybe half an hour to an hour a day. I mean, a lot of it is kind of cleaning up the comments, which are kind of crazy. But it's great. And then every morning I tweet out a 140-character homily for people. Mm. Just for the heck of it. And I always say to people, you know, this, I won't say who, this person came up to me after Mass and said, you know, I don't think it's really appropriate that you, you know, are tweeting and you're kind of, you know, kind of denigrating the gospel. And I looked up all the Beatitudes, you know, blessed are the poor, but they're all under 140 characters.
Okay,
and I tweeted them out one day just to kind of, you know, show people that you could say things with substance in less than 140 characters.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus did, and so why shouldn't we? But really, the point is that's where people are. And so why not go where they are?
Mm-hmm. So we're talking around Christmas time. I think we're going to be airing this the weekend. Well, it'll go live, like, on Christmas Day.
And
we'll
be airing. Nice.
Yeah. We're talking around Christmas time, and I'm actually not a big Christmas person, mostly because I just am so discouraged by what's happened to it, what we've done
to
it.
Well, that makes two of us.
And it's not even, I mean, the commercial thing is part of it, and the compulsory gifts and all that. But it's also, you know, I hate the way, this is strong language, but I dislike.
No, I think I agree with you.
Yeah, I dislike the way the Christmas story has also just been turned into a children's story, right? You know, it's the children's pageant, and it does lend itself to that. But I feel,
which we don't do with the crucifixion, for example.
No, you don't. And I don't. You know, I just feel like this. Even in churches, the story itself doesn't have its fullness. I just wanted to
I think it's been tamed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only been commodified and commercialized, but it's been tamed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice, pretty story about, you know, two nice, good-looking people, usually white, you know, had a pretty baby in a manger. But in a sense, it's a terrifying story, you know, in terms of what they had to undergo. And it's also, I have to say, it is a shocking story. It's not just a baby. It is God being born in human form. And it's just as shocking as the resurrection. And I think we've tamed it. And it, in a sense, it doesn't demand our belief. We can just kind of look on it and say, well, that's cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But if you say to people, do you believe that that is God incarnate in that stable? You know, what does that mean for you, that God comes to us as the most helpless being that you could imagine? You know, the sort of crying and wetting his pants and, you know, needing to be nursed. What does that say to us about who God is for us and how God is for us and how much God loved us to do that? And that, I think, is an entirely different story than, you know, the kind of Christmas cardy stuff that we see. So it's been tamed. And the reason is, I think, it's too frightening, in a sense, to have to make that ascent, to say yes to that, to the nativity and to the incarnation, which is shocking.
Mm.
I mean, it's shocking for people. So we set it aside. I have to say, I am, like, really getting to the point where I'm starting to loathe the Christmas season. The commercialism makes me. I saw Chris Rock recently on Saturday night. I don't know if you saw him. And he was talking about Jesus's birthday season. And he says, you know what? We have taken the person who's probably the least commercial person who's ever lived and turned his birthday into. And he said, not just his birthday, but there's a whole season around it.
Yeah.
You know, and I turned on the TV the other day and I saw an advertisement for Mary Techmas from Walmart. I thought, oh, for Pete's sake, you know, at least can at least
God, I just
put
got
the,
it
the word.
Yeah, that's terrible. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's mm-hmm. that. But I think on a deeper level, what you're pointing to is we've tamed the story. And it's just kind of cute now.
Yeah.
It's what we do with Jesus and the saints.
Sorry, what?
It's what we do with Jesus and the saints.
Right.
Jesus is kind of this nice guy and he loves people and saints are really holy. And versus Jesus was the Son of God who was crucified and rose from the dead and is now alive. And the saints are people who committed their lives totally to Christ and would do anything for him. Versus Jesus is this kind of like hippie guy who I kind of like. And Francis of Assisi was this kind of cool hippie who I put, you know, in a garden, you know, as a little statue. I pat him on the head.
Well, you know.
You know, we do that with current day saints, too. Someone like Dorothy Day, Mother Teresa.
Right.
You know, I mean, these are kind of signs of contradiction for us. And we tame them. It's easier that way. They don't make a claim on us then.
Yeah, they're all of these characters are like Thomas Merton, who we talked about at the beginning. What was that? What's the phrase used about him? Wonderfully complicated, full of wonderful mm-hmm. contradictions,
mm-hmm.
But fully human, messily human.
Yeah, and that's the the saints' lives are usually sanitized, and they become the same. They're all the same. They all prayed the same way. They all did the same things, but very different. I mean, St. Peter is very different from Thomas Merton, who's very different from St. John the 23rd, who's very different from Francis of Assisi and St. Therese of Lisieux. And these are very different people. As Merton said, for me to be a saint means to be myself.
Hmm.
And I remember in the novitiate, there was a young novice who would get up in the morning at 6:30 and pray all the time. And I thought, well, gee, to be holy, I guess I have to do that. So I'd get up and I'd pray, and I was falling asleep all the time.
Hmm.
And then there was another novice who was super quiet. So I thought, oh, I have to be really quiet and diffident and sort of soft-spoken. And my spiritual director said to me, what's wrong with you? You're so quiet. And I said, well, so-and-so's quiet, and he's really holy. And he said, you know, in order to become holy, you don't become someone else. You know, you just become yourself. So there's a sense that we forget that the saints were themselves, too, and Jesus was himself. We tame them. Take all the rough edges off of them, and we put them on a pedestal, and then they make no claim on us because we say, well, we can't possibly be like that. We can't be perfect like they were without any rough edges. So therefore, I don't have to be a saint. I don't have to try. And that's what happens, and that's how we let ourselves off the hook from holiness, from the call to holiness.
Hmm. There's that question that Jesus asked his disciples, who do you say that I am?
Mm-hmm.
You reflect and write about this. I want to ask you, and I think this is, I don't really think this is a fair question because it's such a big question, but you know, how'd you begin to answer that question?
Well, funny enough.
You just wrote
I just spent my last retreat thinking about that question.
Okay, so. Well, share with us a little bit of what you came up with.
Sure. Healer and liberator is what comes up to me when I pray about that. Healer, the person who heals me from unfreedoms and, you know, patterns that have kept me bound. And it's the same as liberator, the one who liberates me from all those things. And certainly friend. So I love that question. You know, who do you say that I am? He asked the disciples and they kind of hem and haw. And then he finally asked Peter, you know, who do you say that I am? And he says the Messiah. But I had a really interesting experience where my spiritual director said to me, now I want you to ask Jesus that question in your prayer.
So,
who do you say that I am?
Jesus. Who do you say Jim Martin is? Or who?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I struggled with it for a day or two. And it was really frustrating because I thought, you know, prayer's not always rich. I thought, Jesus, boy, you know, how about some help here? And so get this. So they had a healing service at the retreat house one night, and we were all supposed to kind of sit down, and people were supposed to pray over us. And this sister, I was sitting in the chair and thinking about this prayer. And this question, who do you say that I am, Lord? Who am I for you? And the sister came up and put her hands on me. And after she prayed a prayer of healing over me, she leaned down. And this was not part of the script. You're not supposed to talk to people during this particular ceremony. She leaned into my ear and she said, know that you are God's beloved son. Isn't that beautiful?
Hmm.
I went back to my seat and I had these images of myself as a young boy being loved by God and, you know, in my Cub Scout uniform and then in junior high school and high school. I'm being very personal right now. I'm sharing with you my retreat and all throughout my life and God loving me just for who I was, not really doing anything, but just who I was.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this experience of God's loving me, which I'd never had before.
Wow.
And so who do you say that I am? That works both ways. And it did for me, but healer and liberator and friend. So that was my last. I just summed up my retreat in 30 seconds.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, sure. But I just want to say something.
Yeah.
You know, we say, you know, how does God speak to us? You know, and that came through someone's voice.
Right.
You know, and then a subsequent prayer experience. I didn't have a vision. I didn't hear God's voice. But I did hear God's voice through that sister who whispered that in my ear, who, you know, who knows why she was motivated to do that other than the Holy Spirit. So there are ways that we have of listening to God, I think, that are accessible to everybody. You know, if they're just open and aware.
Hmm.
Happens all the time. The Creator deals directly with the creature, as St. Ignatius says.
Back to St. Ignatius.
Always back to St. Ignatius.
I did want to ask
There's an old joke that a Jesuit can't talk for 10 minutes without mentioning St. Ignatius.
I think you may have just gone 15 or 20, but... I did want to ask you, actually, you know, Pope Francis is a Jesuit, but he took the name Francis and not Ignatius. So we talked a little while ago about how wonderful it was to be a Jesuit and have him be Pope. But I wonder how does that make sense to you, that he is
The taking
Francis
of the name?
Yeah, the taking of the name for another order.
Yeah, no, I'm laughing because at the beginning, you know, the day he was elected, our Jesuit community was absolutely astounded and tongue-tied and confused and elated. And someone said, "What about the name Francis?" And someone said, "Well, he's clearly it's Saint Francis Xavier, you know, the Jesuit saint." And the next day he said, no,
really?
Which is a very Jesuitical way of looking at it.
Right.
And the next day he said, no, it's Francis of Assisi, because, you know, he wanted to honor the poor and to kind of show his commitment to the poor. I think it's actually pretty brilliant because he's marrying Ignatian spirituality with Franciscan spirituality. And, you know, with that one gesture, now there is another example of Ignatian detachment or freedom. No one had ever taken that name before.
Hmm.
A less free man would have thought, I can't do that. I can't do that. You know, that's never been done before. He's free. You know, Jorge Mario Bergoglio was free enough to say, I'm choosing Francis. And interestingly, he said that what had happened was a cardinal, before he was about to take the name, I guess as he was being elected, a Cardinal Umes, I think, from Latin America, leaned over and said to him, don't forget the poor.
Hmm.
Before he accepted. And so he says, I take the name Francis. And funny enough, one Jesuit in our community, I think I can share this, said, I wish he had taken Ignatius. And another Jesuit said, no, that would have been way too much. You know, a Jesuit pope named Pope Ignatius, you know, would have been like, enough with the Jesuit spirituality. And funny enough, I thought that he was actually going to keep the Jesuits at arm's length at the beginning, because I thought, well, he can't, you know, favor us too much. But he's been very warm to the Jesuits and has said Mass in our churches in Rome and has talked about we Jesuits, and which I just find delightful. I mean, I try not to get too caught up in the proud moment of, you know, having a Jesuit pope, but I just find him and his whole papacy delightful.
Yeah, and, you know, it's very interesting to me. Well, two things, and they do seem to – I don't think they're the same, but they're coinciding a little bit. I feel like there's this kind of universal, not universal, but there's a lot of love for St. Francis that's coming from all kinds of places, including all kinds of Protestants who, well, I mean, the history is not of Protestants loving the Pope, right?
To put it mildly.
And parts of Protestantism that have been most hostile to the Pope or most suspicious of the Pope historically, and young people who are not at all religious, but really in love with this pope.
Yeah.
There's that. And then there's something that I think you also have your finger on the pulse of. I think Jesus is kind of making a comeback too, right?
Thank God.
There's this fascination with the person of Jesus, which
which
is not necessarily connected with the church. Or an experience of the church. Again, here we are talking at Christmas. I just would be curious about your observations of
that.
Well,
you know, I think the two are related. I think that people are attracted to Pope Francis because they find him an authentic Christian. And in him they see signs of Christ, Christ's presence. And that kind of holiness is naturally attractive. Now, why is that? That's one way that God has of drawing us to God's self. We see holy people and we're attracted to them. You know, people wanted to be around Mother Teresa or Pope John Paul, or they want to be around Pope Francis, right? I want to be around Pope Francis. I'd love to meet him at some point. Why is that? It's not simply celebrity or fame or renown. It's holiness. It draws us. And that's one way that God has of drawing us closer, you know, to God. And that's one reason I think Jesus was so beset by crowds in the Gospels. You know, they say, you know, he had to withdraw from the crowds, you know, because they were pressing in on him. Why is that? Well, not only because he was offering them healing and because they wanted to hear his word, you know, and his preaching, but his holiness. Just a man. I would say to people this, okay, so you love Pope Francis and you're around him and you feel that he's very holy, right? Or you see pictures of him and you just want to be near him because he seems so holy. Imagine what it would have been like to be around Jesus. You know, imagine that, you know, and his magnetism and his charisma and just the person of God. I love thinking about that. And so no wonder people wanted to be around him. So what they see in Francis is they see a window into Christ, which is beautiful. That's what the church should be. Church should be welcoming people into a relationship with Jesus, and that's what the Pope is trying to do. That's what all popes have tried to do. But I think this one has a special way of doing it, and I think it's because they find him very authentic and very relatable and personable.
Hmm.
I think some of that comes from his Jesuit background, not all of it, because, you know, we Jesuits, we have to be very careful about overemphasizing that and, you know, he's this because he's a Jesuit, he's that because he's a Jesuit. But I do think there's something essential about his sort of Jesuit freedom and his Ignatian detachment. He's free, he's with the poor, he's open to new things, he's open to new people, he's spontaneous, and that is the Jesuit ideal, the person who is free. And I think you see that. I think people are responding to that, and I'm just so happy. You know, he could be a Dominican, a Benedictine, a diocesan priest, and I'd be happy that he was doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
He's just, because the important thing is he's bringing people to Jesus Christ, or at least getting them to think about him again.
Mm. So we do have a little bit of time. You said you had some jokes. Do you have any jokes about Dominicans, Benedictines?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? Yeah, like 100 of them.
Okay, so you said some of them are good. So tell us one that we would universally...
Well, yeah, I wouldn't tell you my bad ones. I'm not going to tell you the bad ones. Let me think. My favorite one. Let's see. Which one should I tell you? So it's a very quick joke. I'll make it quick. So a Franciscan and a Jesuit are driving together, and they get into this big argument about who's the best religious order, you know, and why did Pope Francis take this name, and they get distracted, and they hit a telephone pole, and they go up to heaven. So they're dead, and they're up in heaven, and they're kind of bummed out because, you know, they're dead. But they're in front of the pearly gates, and the gates open up, and out rolls this red carpet in front of the Jesuit. And out come all these Jesuit saints, and they greet him. And St. Ignatius comes out, the founder of the Jesuits, and the Jesuit's just amazed. And then a blue carpet rolls out, and Mary comes out, and she greets the Jesuit. And he's amazed. You know, it's Mary coming out to greet him. And then a white carpet rolls out, and Jesus Christ himself comes out, greets the Jesuit, and says, "Welcome to heaven." So they all go back into heaven. The red carpet and the blue carpet and the white carpet roll up, and the gates close again, and the Franciscan's waiting out there, and he's just agog. And he's waiting around, and an hour passes, 2 hours passes, 3 hours passes. He's waiting for all of his saints to come out and someone to greet him. Finally, a little side door opens up, and this little saint with a halo, this Franciscan saint, says, "Hey, buddy, come over here." So the Franciscan goes over, and he sees the little saint, and the little saint says, "Welcome to heaven." And the Franciscan says, "What, is that it?" And the little saint says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Oh, come on." He says, "The Jesuit gets the red carpets and, you know, St. Ignatius, his founder, and Mary and Jesus, and all I get is this crummy welcome." And the little saint says, "Oh, yeah, well, you have to remember something. We get Franciscans up here every day. We haven't had a Jesuit in 250 years.
Okay. All right, that's good.
You want to hear another one just for the hell of it?
Okay, yeah.
A guy is trying to find some help with a problem he has. So he knocks on the door of a Dominican church, and he says, "Do you say the rosary here?" And the Dominican says, "Yeah." He says, "You know, we're Dominicans." And he says, if I give you a little donation, will you say a rosary for an intention I have?" And the Dominican says, "What's your intention?" And he says, "I want a Lexus." And the Dominican says, I don't know what that is. And the guy says, "Well, forget it. I'll go to a Franciscan church." So he goes to a Franciscan church, knocks on the door. Guy opens up in his brown habit. He says, "Will you say a rosary if I give you a donation and if I, you know, tell you my intention?" And the Franciscan says, "Sure, I'm happy to do that. What's your intention?" And he says, "I want a Lexus." And the Franciscan said, "What is that?" And he says, "Forget that." So he says, "I'll go to the Jesuits." So he knocks on the door. A guy opens up and he says, "Are you a Jesuit?" "Yep." He says, "Listen, before I go any further, I need to ask you something." He says, "Do you know what a Lexus is?" He goes, "Do I know what a Lexus is?" He says, "You know, half my parishioners drive Lexuses or Lexi." And he says, "Will you say a rosary for my intention if I give you a little donation?" And the Jesuit says, "Yeah. What's a rosary?"
Okay,
those I literally have about 50 of those jokes.
All right,
so.
Well, I'm glad I asked. This has been really fun and wonderful. So thank you so much. I have one quick question I want to ask you, and this will not be in the show. Well, two things. Mm-hmm. I almost, you know, there's also that prayer of Thomas Merton from Thoughts in Solitude.
Mm. Beautiful.
You and I were captured by exactly the same books and the same passages.
Mm-hmm.
I almost was going to ask.
I should interview you. I'd love to hear your story, too.
I was going to ask you to bring that, and then it was too late. But we may just put it up and say that it's your favorite prayer.
Yeah, I can read it.
Do you
like
have
me to
it?
Read it?
I'll call it up on my
phone.
I would love for you to read it.
Yeah. I love. Okay. You know what? And I'm going to say something before I read it.
Okay. And let me just ask, are we okay if we have 5 more minutes? Okay. So we'll do mm-hmm. this, and then I have one question for you that's for something online.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So this is from Thoughts in Solitude, and it's my favorite Thomas Merton prayer, and it is a prayer I find that everyone can pray.
Yeah.
My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone."
Thank you. Wonderful.
I love that prayer.
I love it too, and I hadn't read it for years and years.
Everyone can pray it.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
We asked people last year, kind of our listeners and readers online, to share memories and recollections about Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everybody, instead of talking about Christmas, talked about Advent with this warmth and intimacy that was really surprising and kind of
mm-hmm.
stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to ask you, is this something true for you? Or, you know, how would you want to talk about the season of Advent and how you think that might speak to people at this time of year?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So the question is, how do I understand Advent? Or
well, is Advent meaningful for you? And what is it about Advent that speaks to you and that you think speaks to others in a special way?
Yeah. All right, let me. I got something I want to just look up for a second. Hold on. Don't record this part.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I like Advent more than Christmas because it is free of a lot of the commercialism. You don't have, you know, Advent cards and Advent gifts and things like that. But also I love the readings of Advent. The whole movement in the Christian liturgical season in the readings are these beautiful readings about, you know, God bringing life to the desert and beautiful marshlands springing into bloom and the lion laying down with the lamb and rivers on the bare heights and cedars in the desert. So it's just this beautiful imagery of God kind of bringing new life out of something that is dry and dead. And I love the story of John the Baptist and the Annunciation and the coming of Jesus, which I find unbelievably beautiful. And so, in a sense, the Advent season, you know, which is all about preparation for Christmas, is a season of deep spirituality. And if you can focus on that, you know, it usually makes your Christmas a lot more meaningful. So I much prefer Advent over Christmas. And if we're up to me, you know, we'd get rid of a lot of the Christmas cards and gifts and just focus on Advent.
Okay. All right. That's great. Well, it's just been such a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Like I said, I really enjoy this and I love your show.